Now, you tell me, why would Beyonce ever headline Coachella again to get a $4 or $5 million check per weekend? It doesn't make sense. Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. It's officially springtime. That means that music festival season is here. But this year doesn't quite have that same bang that past seasons have had. Certain music festivals have announced that they're either taking a pause or not coming back for future years. It's time to pour some out for the Made in America Music Festival, Beale Street Music Festival, Firefly, and a countless list of others. But then there's also some slip in demand for the big festivals too. As recently as a couple of weeks ago, you could still get tickets to certain days for Coachella. It may seem somewhat ironic since the live music industry has hit record revenues and profits post-pandemic and the biggest stars in the world are doing extremely well on their tours, but that may also be part of the challenge. And to talk about it today, I'm joined by Tati Sirisano from Media Research. Last year, we did an episode called The Business Behind Coachella, which if you haven't listened to, you should listen to. It's a good deep dive, and there's a lot of evergreen stuff in that episode. But this one, it's time to talk about the current lay of the land. How did music festival culture even get to the point that it did in the 2010s? Was there certain things from that point that weren't sustainable? Where are we now, and what does the future look like? So come join us as we do a deep dive into where things are going, especially as festival season is here. All right, today we're going to do a deep dive about music festivals and the current state of music festivals, because a lot's changed in the past couple of years, and it's not just the pandemic. I'm joined by friend of the pod, Tati Sirisano. Welcome back.
Thanks, Dan. It feels like it was a month ago that we did that episode on Coachella, but I guess that was almost a year ago now, which is crazy.
It's funny because I'll still get hit up about that episode. A lot that I still agree with from that, but a lot's changed too. Before we get to the decline or anything like that, it's probably good to just take a step back and talk about what led to the big boom that we saw for music festivals. In the 2010s, that's when things really took off in terms of Coachella expanding to be on multiple weekends and everyone seeing the success of Coachella and wanting to do it themselves. It hit millennials as a generation in this very timely way of them valuing experiences over material things. Plus, you have Instagram and people wanting to see and be seen somewhere that you can take a photo and the conversions of these things, plus streaming. And you have this big boom that we saw for over a decade of these music festivals being these tentpole cultural events.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of those things. And I think festivals like Coachella were able to kind of turn the music festival into almost like a lifestyle and a brand, which I know is something that we talked about on that episode. And there was this whole era of celebrities going to Coachella. Like, I specifically remember the Vanessa Hudgens photos and things like that would pop up everywhere of the outfits and the celebrities that were there. And the whole thing just kind of became a brand and an aesthetic that I think tied a culture to it and made people more interested. And that rippled out, not just in Coachella, but like just rippled out to other festivals as well. And I think there was also this element of the surprises that would happen at these festivals, like when there was the Tupac hologram and like Swedish House Mafia like reunited or something at like Ultra. There just were always
Outkast too.
There were always these moments of like surprise that I think people wanted to be there for. And I guess that still happens, but maybe it doesn't happen as much.
These festivals had an influence on music too. Thinking about David Guetta, Calvin Harris, Tiesto, Avicii, all of these DJs that rose to prominent power in the 2010s and really shaped pop music and EDM becoming pop music. Where was the setting that people would have and listen to their music? It was festivals and people wanting to replicate that, wanting to have that type of experience over and over. It did have a bit of this symbiotic relationship with the music industry too.
It's a really good point with EDM especially and how there was sort of like this boom for the genre in the early 2010s. I think the symbiotic relationship where like the rise of EDM fed into the rise of festivals and vice versa.
I know we're focusing a lot on Coachella, but in the 2010s, that's when they expanded to two weekends and that's essentially doubling the revenue that they can get because of how much more they're then charging for tickets. You can charge for one weekend versus the other. And then people now see by the time you hit 2017, 2018, a music festival can be $100 million revenue event. And that's a number that they've continuously been able to hit at. So then you see all of these other festivals trying to copy and trying to replicate, and you just see this big boom. The challenge, though, is that people likely underestimated how much work goes into building a brand and building a festival. You go back and look at some of those early years of Coachella, it wasn't always the easiest thing of the world. The first one that they had was in 1999. They didn't even have one in 2000 just because the first one didn't make money. You're trying to get things to come back. And then in 2001, they had another tepid event. And there's this funny review from 2001 in April where the LA Times title is called Coachella Rides Out a Bump in the Road. In credit to them for being able to make a profit earlier on, but that just wasn't the case with a lot of these festivals. And there were a few things, right? It's a pretty low barrier entry thing to start one, because if you're able to get a line of credit, especially in a lower interest rate environment like we had in the 2010s, people could start these festivals. And if you can get headliners and if you had some connections and money to be able to do that, you had people that were willing to give you the space to make it happen. And especially if you didn't have access to get to Coachella, you wanted to have your own Coachella Lite experience. So there was a really timely moment for it. But like a lot of things that were relative to zero interest rates, it just wasn't sustainable.
The festival market just became really oversaturated as a result of all that. There's more festivals than I could even, you know, research. There's festivals all over. And a lot of times they end up having kind of similar lineups. I think they kind of can cannibalize each other's sales a little bit. Like, I think we also are just in this market where it's so oversaturated that there was almost bound to be sort of like a cutting back on how many festivals are out there.
And this was even before the pandemic, which is important for people to realize. Things started to have their cutbacks, and you started to see more articles around that in 2019. One of the ones that stuck out to me was they were planning to do Woodstock 50. This was a concert they were going to do in 2019 to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. They were going to get Jay-Z. They were going to get Chance the Rapper. They had a lot of these big name folks that were involved with the process, but they just couldn't get things together, that whether it was buy-in for this, buy-in for that. And that was one of those where it was one of the few festivals where I felt like there was true building in public just because of the name Woodstock. You have all this attention, and they were quite open about some of the challenges they had getting things up to scale. So just imagine what it's like for a lot of these festivals that are trying to get the same exact artists, the same exact folks. And it's a lot of the, like you said, it's a lot of the same lineups that you're just seeing consistently. So there were a lot of challenges that were happening even before the pandemic. Totally.
Yeah. To the point where I had completely forgotten about Woodstock 50, but now that you mention it, yeah, I remember that so well. I was at Billboard at the time and we were covering it, and it was just like, there was so much press at the start around it, so much excitement. And then eventually, like, it just kind of crumbled.
But once the pandemic hits, it hits them even harder, because it's not like an artist going on tour and, okay, you have to postpone your tour. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you've already built up some type of product or recognition so that you can go out and do it. But if you're a festival, kind of like we talked about the Coachella example before, you need those regular hits, because if you don't have the opportunity to hopefully break even in 2 or 3 years, you're not going to continue to get lines of credit to make it happen. It's like a startup getting funding. If you're not hitting your numbers, you're not going to be able to get the Series A funding if you didn't say what you were going to do when you raise money for your seed round. That's the same exact thing that happens with a lot of these festivals. So if you lose momentum when the pandemic comes around, then how do you sustain that? And we've seen that happen to several music festivals. It was just announced that Made in America, the music festival that Jay-Z had launched in collaboration with Budweiser and some other brands, that one had canceled. You had music festivals like Firefly that seemed like one of the stronger ones that was out there. That one had canceled. You have the Beale Street Music Festival in Memphis. I could go on, but there's so many ones that were known, but they just couldn't cut it.
I sort of feel like the pandemic period and like the return of live music had people lose confidence in festivals in a way that individual concerts have been able to overcome, like in terms of things getting canceled, people wanting refunds, not getting it as quickly as they wanted to, like just the frustrations from consumers of these types of things. I feel like people haven't fully gotten over that with festivals and are almost distrustful of them. Also, even before the pandemic and COVID and everything, there would be, you know, artists that would drop out of their headlining set last minute and things like that, that the festivals would have to apologize to the ticket holders for, and then people want refunds and all this. So I think there were a lot of points where it's been difficult for the festivals to keep consumer trust.
The sad but true thing about what you're saying is that artists and their teams can be flighty people. They can be very flighty people. You know this from your time at Billboard even before yeah. that. I know this from doing this long enough. And let's face it, they're less likely to be flighty about something that has their own name on it. So that's one thing. But I do think one of the big shifts is that the individual artists and what they've been able to command on tour, specifically the mega super duper stars, and how much that has changed in a 5-6 year period. And I think someone that we can use as a good example of this is Beyonce. You go back to 2018, her Coachella performance was a landmark event. It was one of the best live performance sets that anyone has seen, especially of our generation. She got paid $4 million per weekend, $8 million total for that event. It was a little bit less than the average gross that she was getting from her formation tour. The set that she did at Dodger Stadium in 2016 for that, she got $6.7 million gross. Granted, she had opening act for that, but there's money that's being split around. But still, it was a little bit less than that. But why does she do it? She does it because one, yes, she did still get paid, but she has the opportunity to do this legendary set. She wanted to make history, first Black woman to ever headline Coachella, and she can make money further down the road by being able to film the footage, sell the rights to Netflix, and do a $20 million deal to release the Homecoming documentary. So everything made sense in that type of way. But if we now fast forward to 2023, when Beyonce's Renaissance tour is grossing more than double what the Formation tour was grossing on a per show basis. You look at the three shows that she did at SoFi Stadium last year for that concert, she grossed over $45 million from ticket sales from those three shows. That's not even counting merch sales. And plus, she then gets the footage from her own concert and then sells that, does a straight distribution deal with AMC to then make $44 million box office from her own concert. Now, you tell me, why would Beyonce in 2023 ever headline Coachella again to get a $4 or $5 million check per weekend? It doesn't make sense.
100%. Yeah, and I think there's two things happening here with that, which is there are, for festivals choosing their headliners or who they want to go out to, there's fewer superstars that can unite everyone. Like we've talked about in a lot of episodes, there are fewer artists that like, everyone agrees on as this is a superstar, this is the mainstream, like things are a lot more fragmented. But then those who do exist would rather do their own tour. So who are you booking as your headliner? I think that that's a tricky situation for festivals right now, is it feels like there aren't as many artists that are big enough to headline, but not too big that they'd rather just tour on their own.
Right. You look at some of the headliners that Coachella's had. I used Beyonce as an example, but Drake headlined Coachella in 2015. Granted, his performance was nowhere near as legendary, to be honest. It's probably a bit forgettable, if we're being frank. But Drake would never headline Coachella again. And he's doing arenas. It's not even like he's doing stadium tours. Yeah. Harry Styles just headlined Coachella in 2022. After him selling out Madison Square Garden for 15 straight nights, is he ever going to do Coachella? Maybe as a legacy artist down the road, but he has no need to now. And even look at Coldplay. They headlined a while back, 2005, but they just had the first $1 billion tour from a group. And you have someone like Jay-Z who, I mean, I don't think that Jay-Z is necessarily grossing that amount on tour, but he's headlined before and he just makes so much money from other stuff. So the A-plus listers, to your point, are gone. So what you're left with now are the A-minus listers and then maybe the B-plus listers. So you look at the Coachella lineup for 2024, the headliners are Doja Cat, Tyler, the Creator, and Lana Del Rey. All great artists, but yeah, Speaking exactly to what we're saying here.
Yeah, it's a different caliber. And I think that this is part of what's behind the fact that people are waiting longer to buy tickets. Like, it used to be that Coachella would always sell out before the lineup was even announced, because people were like, okay, it's going to be someone at the level of a Beyonce or a Drake. Like, I might as well buy the ticket because it's surely going to be, you know, something like that. And now I think that they feel a little bit more like, well, I actually want to wait and see what the headliners are and see if that actually fits in with what I want to see. It's not so much of like a guaranteed win for that many people.
Lana Del Rey is great, but there's a reason that when Taylor Swift wins Album of the Year, she brings up Lana Del Rey next to her. It's not the other way around.
I could talk about that moment, but I won't. We'll leave that for another episode.
You have the artist who can command the audiences less strongly than the A-plus listers can. And although we talked about Coachella being one of the concerts that can sell its lineup without listing the artist, we've seen a little bit of decline in the demand there too, not necessarily from a sellout perspective, but in how quick they're able to sell out. Exactly. Coachella used to be able to sell out under 3 hours both weekends, and that's no longer the case. Up until a couple of weeks ago, you could still get tickets to the Doja Cat set in that particular day. So there's a lot that's definitely changed and impacted there, but I just don't necessarily think that that changes. Let's take a break for this week's chart metric stat of the episode. On April 16th, 2023, Frank Ocean, your boy, gave one of the more forgettable Coachella headlining performances. So forgettable that he was replaced on the second weekend by Blink-182. But as of April 2024, Ocean's Spotify monthly listeners have grown 36% since that Coachella performance. It's now at 33.4 million listeners. In fact, in the 31 days after Ocean set, the Spotify monthly listeners grew 8% immediately after that. That Coachella bump is real and still has power, regardless of how memorable or good the performance actually is. Here's to Frank Ocean, a legend. I still think that Blonde is the best album that anyone has released in the past 10 years, but even that Coachella bump can work in his favor. Let's get back to the episode.
And when people are waiting longer to buy tickets, it just adds this element of uncertainty to the festival organizers and promoters that they can't really afford to have. And I think that that's also just kind of like a cultural shift that's happened. Even if the lineups were, you know, the most amazing ever, I still think that people are feeling a little bit more hesitant to commit to things these days because they've been burdened in the past, or because, you know, the cost of living crisis and all these other things. Like, I think that all of that kind of works against festivals that really need to plan very far ahead and have a lot of certainty over how many tickets they're going to sell.
Right. And it makes me think too about the generational shift of the audience as well, because so much of the music festival boom was something that was driven by millennials, whether it was older millennials or younger millennials. That generation really gravitated to that moment. But now we're in a post-pandemic state, and a lot of those people are getting older and they're having families and they're just not of the same generation. So now you have the generation of Gen Z who, maybe some of them had been going to music festivals for years, but now they're definitely becoming more of the sweet spot target audience for a lot of these events. And I wonder how that affects them, because this is a generation that in many ways had their coming of age years during the pandemic. And with that type of mentality behavior, it becomes a little bit tougher to get them out of the house to go do the same types of things that other generations did. There's more entertainment. There's more ways to connect and engage with their friends and the people that they actually want to be with. So if they're going to not just leave their house, but travel to these festivals or camp overnight or whatever the circumstances is, it better be a high bar, because the things that they can do from the comfort of their own area, neighborhood, whatever it is quite high to begin with.
Yeah. And there's more competition for their attention and spend in general too, right? But it's funny, that reminds me the you know, camping and flying and all those things. Remind me, I was thinking about how I remember going to music festivals when I was a teenager and like it just roughing it, you know? Like really, like you were out in the sun for like 12 hours. You were eating like shitty pizza. It's not like now where there's like, you know, all these stands with like really good food and whatever. And it was kind of a rough experience, but you did it because there was something in that was like the charm of it. And you were going through it with your friends. And it was like, but it was very like Lord of the Flies out there. Right. And I don't know that Gen Z is willing to put up with that. Like, I almost feel like there's this new generation has sort of higher standards for these sorts of things. And I think that might be an element here too. Like maybe they don't want to go and, you know, get this GA ticket that's already hundreds of dollars and not have a place to sit down or, you know, not be able to get free water, which I think most festivals have now, but a lot don't. Like they might just kind of be fed up with that experience. And then the other thing that I think is relevant with Gen Z is just how fragmented their listenership is. Like it's very common for some Gen Z to, you know, you could have a classroom of students and every single one has a completely different set of their favorite artists and the songs that they're listening to right now. Whereas when we were growing up, it was a lot more like there were a handful of, you know, top artists and there were the hits of the moment. So I think that impacts it too, because they might be looking at these lineups and it just doesn't really gel with the way that they listen to music.
Right. It's the music festival version of when I was your age, I walked 10 miles to school in the snow.
Exactly.
The other thing that I want to talk about is the artist-led festivals.
Yeah.
Where an artist is putting their name on to be like, hey, this is my show. This is my thing. Come through. We're going to have a bunch of artists to have them in. We definitely saw a lot of them. We've seen a lot of artists pull back from them. We've also saw the tragedies like Travis Scott's Astroworld festival that he'd had in 2021. But this is also something that I don't think we've seen as much. And I think a lot of the artists that maybe did them have been able to kind of quietly pull back. And this is something else that I think probably made a lot more sense in a pre-pandemic world. But even then, we started to see a little bit of the decline and pullback there. This actually reminds me, talking about Taylor Swift, when she had released that 2019 album, Lover, her plan was to do a artist-centric festival. One weekend it was going to be in LA and one weekend it was going to be in Boston. Obviously, those plans didn't go through, but I'm sure it made so much better financial sense for her to eventually do the Eras Tour, where she's grossing $17 million on average per stadium that she's doing, which probably wasn't even thought of as being something that was on the potential radar back when she had those plans. So much has just clearly changed. A lot of these artist festivals, they're just not as abundant as they once were either.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to what you were saying at the start, where it's hosting a festival sounds really fun, but then you start to look at the actual process for that and the costs and the organization and everything, and it's like, oh, actually, maybe... maybe not. And especially if you're an artist who wants to focus on so many other things, maybe you just feel like you don't necessarily have the time to dedicate to big projects like this. I also wonder if there's a fear of liability attached to that, not just because of what happened at Astroworld, but there's always people who need medical help at these festivals. There's always like extreme weather events where, you know, you got to cancel the date and then you got to refund everybody. Like there's a lot of potential for liabilities that I think it's, you don't have as much of that potential just when you're doing a normal tour. So I think that might be part of it as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think too, because the more that generations evolve, the less willing they are to put up with stuff. There were a lot of health hazards and things like that can happen, especially at these newer festivals that haven't got the kinks and everything else worked out. It's important to keep in mind that context of this is the first time that this business is putting on its product. You are attending the beta version, the first time that anyone else has. There was an opportunity to really test this out. They saw how some other people did it. Hopefully they had some experience before, but now they're starting it and you all are the guinea pigs for how this works. And whether it's Woodstock, both with Woodstock 50 when they tried to do that, Woodstock 99, there was also a logistical nightmare. And Rolling Loud is another one that, especially in some of those early years, there had been some challenges there with different logistics. And granted, they do have a number of reps under them at this point, but those types of things, acting as like a power log where the festivals that have been established, that have been doing this for a while, continue to gravitate and capture the demand and in many ways the trust with consumers. I know for a fact that if I go to Coachella, if I go to Outside Lands, that at least from a safety perspective, I feel that there's going to be a baseline there. That doesn't mean that nothing's going to happen, but there's been enough runs. If I go to one of these newer festivals that just started a year, maybe 2 years ago, maybe someone else goes and tests out the Boeing 737 MAX, and I'll just continue to take the Airbus over here while you all go test that out. Once that's good, maybe if they have the right artist, then I'll come check it out.
Yeah, and I think we also need to talk about literally just the weather. The weather, like these are outdoor events. And I think that there's been more and more extreme weather events that have caused festival cancellations or just people being really unhappy with the experience in recent years. Global warming is having a bigger impact on these things. And just the fact of weather being something you have to consider as a festival that you don't if you're, you know, in an arena, I think that alone like deserves a moment. Just that is a huge, can be a huge issue.
Right. Someone may have been willing to be in the desert in hot temperature times, and they may not be willing to do that anymore. So many of these festivals being in Vegas, people don't want to do that in July and August. That's just not the vibe.
I went to EDC in Vegas a few years ago, and I remember there was just this insane like sandstorm. The wind was crazy. It was freezing. And there was sand being blown in your face the entire time to the point where people were just like covering their eyes, like covering their faces. And people were miserable that things like that, that you can't really predict as a festival and can erode at that trust. I don't know if I would go again after having that experience.
I want to talk about Fyre Festival because that was clearly the Schadenfreude moment of the decade when it comes to music festival failures. But if you had someone running it that wasn't a complete con artist, could this have worked? And I do think that back in 2017, with some professionals in the room and a few reps under it, the concept makes complete sense. You think about all of the luxury type of experiences that people have that are out here and all of the private gigs that these artists have performed at. And if you're able to assemble enough demand and enough people with money that want to make it happen, if they can get Rihanna and Beyonce to perform for $10, $20 million at these private weddings, then you can create a type of luxury experience to bring together for these people. It doesn't need to be in this type of way where you need to sell tens of thousands of tickets to break even, but could you sell a couple hundred or maybe a few thousand to make it work? Like, I've always thought that that was possible, especially in the late 2010s. But I still do think something like that is possible in 2024. But you would just need to have the right set of artists and things to be contained enough where you can make the economics work, because the ticket prices would be enough and any brand or company that wants to be involved would be willing to pay.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that it could work. Just music tourism in general, I think there's a bigger opportunity for it, because it kind of just, it's more bang for your buck, right? It's more of a reason to spend this money on a festival if you're also going to this island and there's like this luxury experience and all of that. I do wonder if the current climate could work with that, because there's like a lot of backlash against extreme wealth right now. I can just picture the headlines if like that type of like luxury festival got announced, and I can picture there being backlash against artists for being part of it. But I do think there's a world where it could work, and I don't necessarily think that it would be a bad thing.
It's a type of experience that I wouldn't be surprised to see happen somewhere in the Middle East or in Saudi Arabia, something that is somehow funded by the kingdom's public investment fund.
Yeah, I can see that.
The same way that music festival like Soundstorm, the amount that they pay has been on par with what we've seen from Coachella and other festivals. So if those folks are willing to pay up the guarantees, especially if they're willing to pay guarantees that rival what these post-pandemic A-plus superstars are getting on tour, if you can get them and get them with enough money, that could change the dynamic a bit. To your point, it would be ridiculed and there would be a lot of hate because, one, you have the extreme wealth aspect of it. Two, where the wealth is coming from and all the debates we've seen about money coming from that region with sports washing. It would be controversial for sure. But I'm also saying that I think it's probably inevitable that we'll see something like that.
Yeah, I think
we know that the A-listers, the A-plus listers, the economics work out better for them. Are there any artists that we think may buck this trend, though, that we think can hold out and still be enough to drive demand for a Coachella, a Lollapalooza, a Bonnaroo, Outside Lands, or any of these other bigger festivals?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, Kendrick headlined Coachella last year.
It wasn't that long ago.
Someone that would come to mind for that. But I also don't know the economics of, I don't know how much he made on his last tour. Maybe Rihanna? Her Super Bowl halftime show was a bit divisive.
Okay. That. I'm going to talk about Rihanna in a second. But in terms of Kendrick, he did four shows at Crypto.com Arena in Los Angeles, grossed just over $7 million. So if you do the math there, less than $2 million per show. And if assumed that he got $4 million per week into headline, then for someone like him, headlining Coachella is, I'll do that 10 times and again on Sunday. Like, sign me up.
Totally.
We should talk about Rihanna, though, because she did that concert for the Indian wedding a couple of months ago. The responses that people had to the videos weren't the kindest. I think people don't realize what it's like to be at some of these like private events. I've been to some of them, and half of the people there are trying to network. They're on their phones. They're trying to just hang out. The Super Bowl was the exact opposite. Instead of when it comes to the audience and 120 million people, plus all the people that watch it online, and there were still mixed reviews there.
But did you have any artists in mind for that question?
Kendrick is a good one, because I think the sweet spot is someone that can do an arena run, but couldn't do a stadium run. Someone like a Nicki Minaj. I probably would have said Lana Del Rey before. She now is headline. Olivia Rodrigo could probably headline Coachella and have a pretty strong audience and showing there. Would she want to headline Coachella again 3-5 years after that? Maybe not, just based on the career trajectory. I think you can get artists that are on the rise up. Even someone like Doja Cat. If that continues, though, will she be an artist that's doing stadiums? And will she want to do Coachella 5 years from now? Who knows?
Where do you think Ariana Grande stands in this? Because she headlined Coachella. I saw that show. Her and Nicki were up there. It was great. It was so good. But yeah, curious what you think about her.
I think she also falls in this category. I still think that this is a pretty good gig for her where she's at. But we'll see. We'll definitely have to see this and circle back. And I'm sure next year around this time, especially when Coachella starts, it's good to have some type of pulse. Where's the state of the business? We were able to have the Business of Coachella episode last year, and then now we have this one.
Do you have any festivals coming up in your agenda?
Yeah, I'll go to Outside Lands. I haven't bought tickets yet.
I haven't even. I went 1 year. It was great.
I've gone most years, and I really do enjoy it. Part of it is the convenience. I literally live here. The last headliner is done at a decent hour. I can get home at a decent hour. I know that's the most basic thing to say in the world, but that matters at this stage.
It's true. If I lived in San Francisco, I'd probably do the same thing. I'm going to Primavera in May.
Nice.
And this is my first international festival. I've only ever gone to U.S. festivals before.
So you got SZA and Lana Del Rey, right?
Yeah. It's like on the beach, which is crazy. Your view is the ocean. So I'm so excited. I hope it lives up to the hype in my mind, but I think it's going to be awesome.
Well, we'll definitely have to hear how that one is.
They've had issues in the past. I was looking up reviews, and there's been years where people were not happy with the experience. So I'll be the judge. We'll see.
You'll definitely have to come back on and report back. Tati, thanks again for coming on. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me as always.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.